We'll see you in 7 days. We'll be right here, right back on this position on the radio dial. Thanks a lot.
On WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, this is Kylie Worth with your WSLR news headlines for Friday, July 11th. Sarasota County's number two administrator resigned Wednesday amid stormwater fallout. County officials have not specified a reason for the resignation of Deputy County Administrator Mark Cunningham. However, his exit follows recent revelations about failures in the county's stormwater management, which Cunningham was assigned to oversee. A joint investigation by the Florida Trident and Suncoast Searchlight found that the county ignored repeated warnings, failed to maintain key flood control infrastructure, and allowed critical staff vacancies to go unfilled, all of which contributed to catastrophic flooding in the 2024 storm season. Cunningham's resignation comes just days after the Sarasota County Commission voted to create a standalone stormwater department. This department is part of a broader restructuring effort following public outcry. Cunningham's departure is effective at the end of the month. New construction at the hospital in Venice can now go up. The Venice City Council this week gave preliminary approval to a new zoning district for Sarasota Memorial's Venice Hospital. This will allow the hospital to expand its existing campus 150 feet upwards, mirroring the appearance and design of the downtown Sarasota location. This was per request of the Sarasota Memorial Healthcare System. The amendments and rezoning were approved in a 6-1 vote. One council member, Ron Smith, voiced concerns about doubling the height from 5 to 10 floors being out of character for the small city. He also questioned giving this benefit solely to Sarasota Memorial Hospital. In other Venice news, Venice Theater has now received 80% of the necessary funding needed to rebuild. In 2022, Hurricane Ian brought major destruction upon its main stage theater. Since then, they have been raising money for reconstruction. Governor Ron DeSantis last week signed off on a $350,000 grant approved by the state legislature. Challenge matches have been made by the City of Venice and the Pinkerton family. This could give the theater an additional $500,000. They hope to reopen their doors by next year. This has been Kylie Worth with your WSLR news headlines for Friday, July 11th.
The following program was pre-recorded in front of an audience of one real live cat. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, who with the music and arts venue Fogartyville provide a center for creative expression and community engagement that amplifies the voices of our diverse community and promotes peace, sustainability, democracy, and economic and social justice. I am Lou Larini. Thanks for tuning in to Surreal News, where we offer opinions, comments, and perspective on the events of the week, which do not necessarily represent the station, its board, or anyone else other than the person who expressed them. I guess the latest kerfuffle in the land of he who would be king is a case of live by the sword, dies by the sword. Apparently, many former ardent supporters are all in a tizzy about the lack of transparency about the Epstein files, which AG Pam Bondi has said did not contain a client list, and that no more files related to the wealthy financier's sex trafficking investigation would be made public. White supremacist and former dinner guest at Mar-a-Lago's Royal Castle, Nick Fuentes, said recently, it was time to burn the MAGA hats. I find it interesting that the king of misinformation, perhaps his only real regal title to which he is entitled, may be taken down by an effort by his minions to tell the truth. Of course, the real motivation for Bondi's sudden turn probably has more to do with protecting her boss than preventing the salacious insinuations about Democrats who may be on the list from being exposed. Stay tuned until 9:30 to hear my interview with Ernesto Ruiz, research coordinator with Farm Workers Association of Florida, who updates us on what life is like these days for migrant farm workers and others in this state. It is worse than he imagined it would be at the beginning of the year and is expected to worsen as the deportation net broadens, warning that ICE may be coming to your house, no matter who you are. Hear how those with settled citizenship may be next. In his all-out war on illegal immigration, President Donald Trump has branded immigrants as criminals, invaders, and predators, as his administration targets millions of Haitians, Latin Americans, gang members, and foreign college students for deportation. Now the president has directed the Justice Department to bolster its resources in a major crackdown on naturalized citizens suspected of unlawfully obtaining their U.S. citizenship. According to a recent memo, the department plans to focus not only on individuals who may have lied about a crime or having done something illegal during the naturalization process, but authorities also plan to focus on others who may have committed a crime after becoming citizens, generally untested legal frontier. Citing Trump's policy objectives in the January 11th memo, the head of DOJ Civil Division instructed government lawyers to go after naturalized citizens who pose a potential danger to national security, such as acts of terrorism or espionage, violated human rights, engaged in international drug trafficking, or committed felonies that were not disclosed during their naturalization application. The DOJ list of priority targets backed by Attorney General Pam Bondi even includes naturalized citizens who have been convicted of defrauding the U.S. government, such as Medicare, Medicaid, COVID-19 loan programs. These categories are intended to guide the Civil Division in prioritizing which cases to pursue. However, these categories do not limit the Civil Division from pursuing any particular case. Assistant Attorney General Brett Schumat wrote in a memo pointing to an expansive interpretation of laws on the revocation of naturalization. A range of critics, including immigration and defense attorneys, say the Justice Department's new priorities for denaturalization cases are extremely broad and vague, allowing the Trump administration to target any number of naturalized citizens for various offenses that may fall outside the scope of the law before trying to deport them to their native country. Ultimately, a federal judge must decide on any government bid to revoke the status of a naturalized citizen, a long process involving likely appeals. Traditionally, the law was intended to apply to individuals who committed an unlawful act before becoming naturalized citizens, particularly if it was an act that was not disclosed during the naturalization process and there was material misrepresentation on the application, Miami immigration attorney Stephen Goldstein told the Miami Herald. What appears to be happening now is an effort to broaden the law's scope, targeting conduct that occurs at any point after naturalization based on interpretations laid out in the memo, said Goldstein, a former federal prosecutor with the now defunct Immigration and Naturalization Service. This administration has aggressively expanded the reach of immigration enforcement, and they've shown they're unafraid to defend these expansions in court. The National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers condemned the Justice Department's new directive. The Trump administration's push to revoke citizenship is alarming and raises serious 14th Amendment concerns, Group President Christopher Wellborn said in a statement. Although the memo purports to target concealment of earlier offenses, the language suggests that any offense at any time may be used to justify denaturalization, he said. This is particularly concerning given the government's reliance on vague claims of gang affiliations and deportations. The impact of the new DOJ policy aimed at U.S. citizens who were born in a foreign country is unclear. According to the Migration Policy Institute, a Washington, D.C. think tank, the United States has about 24.5 million naturalized citizens, a little more than half the country's immigrant population. The cost of the import taxes, called tariffs, is mounting. U.S. trade policies has entered the great in-between, a liminal state in which high tariffs on major trading partners are ostensibly imminent, yet also forever just over the next horizon. The good news for American consumers and businesses is that the potential price shocks and other disruptions from an all-out global trade war remain at bay, and Wall Street is taking this confusing landscape in stride. The bad news is that it's hardly the kind of policy landscape conducive to companies making long-term investments. With a much ballyhooed 90-day negotiation period set to expire this week, President Trump issued a slew of letters announcing new tariffs on major trading partners that are close to those originally announced on April 2nd, Liberation Day. The most economically consequential are the 25% tariffs on imports from Japan and South Korea, major trading partners, and traditional geopolitical allies. But they are not set to go in effect until August 1st, 3 weeks away. On Tuesday morning, Trump insisted that the onset of higher tariffs is real this time, suggesting it's not just a negotiating feint. Tariffs will start being paid on August 1st, 2025. There has been no change to date, and there will be no change, he wrote on Truth Social. No extensions will be granted, he added. Markets have largely shrugged off those threats, betting that Trump envisions further deal-making and implicitly further punting of tariffs ahead. Meanwhile, inflation data came in soft for April and May. Contrary to warnings from business leaders and economists, the tariff-fueled price spikes and shortages could loom. The combination of a booming stock market and lack of evident economic damage from the earlier rollout of tariffs seems to have empowered Trump to keep pushing tariff talk rather than strike quick deals and move on. These are, as Bob Elliott of Unlimited Funds wrote, Schrodinger's tariffs, simultaneously alive and dead. The administration has had room to swing back to a more aggressive policy stance on the trade war because, so far, the effects are not being felt significantly across the economy, he wrote in his newsletter, Non-Consensus. But the big reason why there has not been any impact here is simply because it's taking time to ramp up the prospective tariff collection, and that then is taking time to flow into the real economy, giving normal lags, Elliott argued. The fact that negotiations with countries like Japan and South Korea were at such a stalemate that Trump has reignited the trade war is a sign of a new normal. At a very basic level, nothing actually happened based on Trump sending those letters, so there's no reason to panic over headlines, wrote Tobin Marcus at Wolf Research in a note. But we think that the moves do contain some signal about where the trade war is heading, and that signal is mostly hawkish, he added. By the numbers, if tariffs announced Monday go into effect and remain in place, it will translate to a 17.6% average effective tariff rate on U.S. imports, the Yale Budget Lab estimates, the highest since 1934. That's up from 15.8% previously and up from 2.4% as of January. If sustained, the currently announced tariff regime would translate to a 1.7% rise in consumer prices, costing the average household $2,300 per year, per the Yale Budget Lab. There is a good reason to believe Trump's latest letters on trading partners are a negotiating strategy, but the fact that they exist is a warning sign about the new global trade landscape. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. The measles epidemic is worsening as the anti-vaxxer-in-chief continues to muddy the waters about the best way to stop it. The U.S. in 2025 has recorded its worst measles epidemic in more than 30 years, according to the count released this week by Johns Hopkins University. highlighting a crisis that President Donald Trump's vaccine skeptic health secretary is accused of fueling. The serious and highly contagious disease, once deemed eliminated from the country thanks to vaccines, is making a comeback against a backdrop of falling vaccine rates and growing mistrust of health authorities. A total of 1,277 cases have been confirmed since the beginning of the year in nearly 40 states, with Texas accounting for over 60% of the outbreak, according to John Hopkins. The total U.S. figure is the highest since 1992. The epidemic has so far claimed three lives, all unvaccinated people, including two young children. According to several experts, the toll has been largely underestimated as they express concern about underreporting. The previous measles-related infant death in the U.S. was in 2003, 3 years after measles had been declared officially eradicated thanks to vaccinations. The last major outbreak, recorded in 2019 in Orthodox Jewish communities of New York and New Jersey, with 1,274 cases, but no deaths. Measles is a highly contagious respiratory virus spread through droplets when an infected person coughs, sneezes, or simply breathes. Secretary of Health Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is accused of having exacerbated the health crisis by stoking fears about measles, mumps, and rubella MMR vaccine, a highly effective shot he has falsely claimed is dangerous and contains fetal debris. The epidemic broke out in late January in a rural area of Texas, where a vaccine-skeptical Mennonite Christian community was hit particularly hard. This year's resurgence has also seen neighboring Canada and Mexico experience stronger than usual outbreaks. More than 3,500 cases, including one death, have been recorded this year in Canada, the vast majority in Ontario province. In Mexico, nearly 2,600 cases and 9 deaths have been recorded, according to the Pan American Health Organization. Speaking of RFK Jr., apparently he does not really know what food is good for you. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. this week lauded Mom's Meals, a company providing $7 a portion dishes directly to Medicaid and Medicare recipients. He specifically thanks the term for delivering without additives meals funded by taxpayers to sick or elderly Americans. Their offerings include chicken bacon ranch pasta for dinner alongside options such as French toast sticks with fruit or ham patties. This is really one of the solutions for making our country healthy again, Kennedy said in the video posted to his official health secretary account after he toured the company's Oklahoma facility last week. But an Associated Press review of Mom's Meals, including the ingredients and nutrition labels, shows that the company's foods are the type of heat-and-eat, ultra-processed foods that Kennedy routinely criticizes for making people sick. The meals contain chemical additives that would render them impossible to recreate at home in your kitchen, said Marion Nessel, a nutritionist at New York University and a food policy expert who reviewed the menu for the AP. Many menu items are high in sodium and some are high in sugar or saturated fat, she said. It is perfectly possible to make meals like this with real foods and no ultra-processing additives, but every one of the meals I looked at is loaded with such additives, Nestle said. What's so sad is that they don't have to be this way. Other companies are able to produce much better products, but of course they cost more. Mom's Meals do not have the artificial petroleum dyes that Kennedy has pressured companies to remove from their products, she noted. Mom's Meals said in an emailed response that its food products do not include ingredients that are commonly found in ultra-processed foods. The company does not use synthetic food dyes, high fructose corn syrup, certain sweeteners, or synthetic preservatives that are banned in Europe, said Teresa Ruth, a company spokeswoman. The meals are a healthy alternative to what many people would find in their grocery stores, said Andrew Nixon, U.S. Health and Human Services spokesman, in response to questions about Mom's Meals. Mom's Meals is one of several companies across the U.S. that deliver medically tailored at-home meals. The meal programs are covered by Medicaid for some enrollees, including people who are sick with cancer or diabetes, as well as some older Americans who are enrolled in certain Medicare health insurance plans. It's unclear how much federal taxpayers spend on providing meals through Medicaid and Medicare every year. An investigation by Stat News last year found that some states were spending millions of dollars to provide medically tailored meals to Medicaid enrollees that were marketed as healthy and dietitian approved, but many companies served up meals loaded with salt, fat, or sugar. All staples of an unhealthy American diet, the report concluded. Defining ultra-processed foods can be tricky. Most U.S. foods are processed, whether it's by freezing, grinding, fermentation, pasteurization, or other means. Foods created through industrial processes with ingredients such as additives, colors, and preservatives that you couldn't duplicate in a home kitchen are considered the most processed. Kennedy has said healthier U.S. diets are the key to his vision to make America healthy again. His call for Americans to increase whole foods in their diets has helped Kennedy build his unique coalition of Trump loyalists and suburban moms who have branded themselves MAHA. Encouragement to produce clean energy wanes as the planet warms. President Trump ordered the Treasury Department to take a hard line on the new budget law's phase out of solar and wind credits. His new executive order could make it even harder to access incentives under the law, which now requires projects to start construction within a year and begin operating by the end of 2027. The memo this week demands that Treasury strictly enforce the construction deadline by preventing the artificial acceleration or manipulation of eligibility, among other provisions. It also calls on Treasury to enforce provisions that thwart credits if projects have certain corporate or supply chain ties to China. Trump pledged tough executive actions to help ensure House conservatives who voted for the Senate-passed bill, which took a slightly softer approach. Trump's move on the construction deadline was the obvious intent of raising that standard to impede credit access, TD Cowen Washington Research Group said in a note. The overall order seeks to impose constraints that are similar to initial, more aggressive House plan, they write. Lobbying of potentially legal battles as Trump seeks restrictive implementation of the new law. State lawmakers are denied access to alligator Alcatraz. Wonder what they're hiding. Florida lawmakers showed up to inspect the alligator Alcatraz Immigrant Detention Center days after President Donald Trump visited and less than 24 hours after the first detainees arrived. They were turned away. Outside the chain-link fence at the entrance in the Everglades, Florida lawmakers argued state law grants elected officials access to inspect state-operated facilities without approval and said that not only did the Florida Division of Emergency Management, FDEM, deny their request, but representatives hung up on them mid-call. At this point, we're being denied access, said Rep. Anna Escamani, Democrat from Orlando, as she stood outside the facility on July 3rd with fellow Florida lawmakers, Senators Chevron Jones, Democrat from Miami, and Carlos Guillermo Smith, a Democrat from Orlando, along with Reps. Angie Nixon, Democrat from Jacksonville, and Michelle Rayner, Democrat from St. Petersburg. At first, officials gave the lawmakers no reason to bar them, and then they mentioned safety concerns, which is very alarming to us, because if there are safety concerns in the building, we need to be able to see them. That means the conditions could be unsafe for those who are currently detained or those who are working in the facility, Escamani told USA Today Network Florida. The delegation asked the state if they could at least go and walk around the outside of the facility. That request was also denied, Escamani said. After a couple of phone calls trying to get access, the delegation finally reached the general counsel for FDEM, Stephanie Hoop, who then hung up on them. I was speaking with her about the statutory authority range, said in an interview, we specifically asked what was the difference yesterday when the President of the United States was here versus the safety concerns here now. And she said there were no detainees. And I said, so is it unsafe now for the detainees? And we were not given answers, Rainier said in an interview with USA Today Network Florida. A call late afternoon to FDEM went to voicemail. A message was not immediately returned. The lawmaker said that they have never been denied access to inspect a detention center. I've been in the legislature for 13 years, and I've been to multiple state prisons, facilities, detention centers, and never have gone through an exercise like this, Smith said. The experience we always have as lawmakers is when we show up to a state prison or a municipal detention center, as the statutory right gives us authority to do, Smith said, it should not be different here. The reason it's different here is because they're wanting to hide from the public what is happening inside. The site has attracted heavy criticism from not just Democrats, but also environmentalists, immigration advocates, and Native American tribes with ancestral ties to the Everglades. They argue development will harm the fragile ecosystem of the Big Cypress National Preserve and where Alligator Alcatraz is located, and have concerns about lack of oversight and detention standards. Friends of the Everglades and the Center for Biological Diversity are suing, saying agencies rushed the project without requiring environmental reviews or citizen impact studies. They warn of harm to protected lands and species surrounding the facilities. Florida and U.S. legislators should be fighting against the detention center, said Betty Osceola, an Ochepe resident and member of the Miccosukee Tribe of Indians of Florida. She was standing outside the detention center property watching and taking pictures of the comings and goings. I think what they're doing is an atrocity to the environment and to the public. It's very concerning to me, Osceola said. I know the history of this place. To me, it's a moment to it's a monument to what could have happened in the 70s if it wasn't stopped. Companies building Alligator Alcatraz are concealing their identities. As Governor Ron DeSantis rushed to open the state's new detention facility in the Everglades, the various contractors that helped get the detention center up and running covered up their logos and U.S. Department of Transportation numbers on their trucks entering the site. Photos obtained by New Times show that the semi-trucks arriving at Alligator Alcatraz had the company's name and other identifying information covered up with tape and cardboard. Classic Recycling, whose tape job on one of the trucks did not exactly cover the company's name, tried to hide its USDOT number. Another truck on site completely concealed its name and USDOT info as well, breaking Florida and federal regulations. Immigration activist Thomas Kennedy captured the photos on the same day Democratic state lawmakers were denied access to the facility. Under the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration Commercial Motor Vehicle Marking Final Rule, all interstate motor carriers must display their USDOT number on both sides of the commercial motor vehicle. Florida adopted this regulation and codified it in state law. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. Up next is my conversation with Ernesto Ruiz, Research Coordinator for the Farm Workers Association of Florida.
I'm Lou Verini, and I'm happy to welcome back Ernesto Ruiz, Research Coordinator at the Farm Workers Association of Florida, whose longstanding mission is to build power among farm worker and rural low-income communities. How you doing, Ernesto? Thanks for coming on today.
Thanks, Lou. Doing well, all things considered. Hard times for our communities, as I'm sure you're aware of, but glad to be on the speak with you again.
Yeah. You know, much has changed since the last time we spoke at the beginning of the year, when promises of mass deportation were just that, promises. But the claim that only those who had committed crimes would be targeted has since been broadened to include all migrants. Considering your organization represents farm workers and the fact that about 40% of farm workers in this country are undocumented, what's happening among your members?
Yeah, I guess the best way to characterize it is a generalized panic, generalized anxiety. People are terrified, rightfully so. We're seeing families being torn apart. We're seeing hardworking people that contribute and uplift their communities being detained, arrested, people with legal status being detained and arrested, deported, people not being able to track their relatives for weeks at a time. Sometimes they won't even realize that they've been deported until it's 2 or 3 weeks after they've been detained. We're seeing rampant violation of due processes, and just a very public display of cruelty and of aggressive state power, I think, is the best way to characterize it.
Yeah, so, you know, I imagine, you know, ICE has come to workplaces where FWAF workers are, right? I mean, they come to farms and grab people off.
They do. They have been, yes.
The fields.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. Although I will say in Florida, the majority of detentions and arrests that we're seeing are taking place as a result of traffic stops, usually the Florida Highway Patrol. There have been cases. We have heard of cases where law enforcement officials, ICE, shows up at farms, at nurseries. We've heard of instances in which the farm owners actually, like, help the farm workers hide and escape, interestingly enough. The more concentrated, as we understand it, work raids are taking place in the construction sector. Not to say that they're not happening in farm works, but the farm workers are more impacted, as I mentioned, in traffic stops.
Yeah, there was in fact that incident in Tallahassee where they swooped in and I guess questioned there were almost 200 days anyway. Are people afraid to come to work?
Oh, absolutely. They're terrified to go out of their house for any reason. We've had people refuse advice from doctors telling them you have life-threatening conditions, blood sugars in the 500s, and the individual says, well, I'm going to risk it. I'm not going to go to the ER out of fear of being apprehended there. And granted, there haven't been any apprehensions at the ER, but people are afraid. People aren't taking their kids to schools. We have had people tell us that they're not going to work. We've heard from employers that people aren't showing up. People are trying to stay home as much as possible. So, yeah, people are very, very much afraid.
Well, that's another interesting thing about it's a sad, crazy thing about this whole process is that it seems to me that a lot of people are getting picked up courthouses or places where they're going to try to comply with the rules to earn legal citizenship, and when they show up for their meeting or their court date, ICE is that they claim that all they're after is first of all, they said they claimed they were only going after criminals, but and this isn't novel idea, but everybody has noted that even if they rounded up all the people that all the migrants or immigrants that have been accused or convicted of being criminals, that wouldn't be very many. It would be like 1 or 2%, because most people that are here in this country not documented or I guess illegally are only here to find a job, right? I mean, they're like family people. They're just looking to work, right? They aren't criminals.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And this it's not an opinion. It's fact that's been borne out by decades of research. that consistently documents and shows that immigrants are the least likely to commit crimes, generally speaking, and even more or less likely, or even, yes, even more or less likely to commit violent crime. As you rightly point out, that they're not migrating, leaving their communities, their homes, their families, their language, their food to come here. Where they are oftentimes mistreated, not always, but oftentimes, they're not doing this because they want to. It's not a joyous opportunity. It's a move of desperation. It's a last-ditch resort to try to provide for themselves, for their families, or to escape from war-torn or gang-torn areas. And it's really important when you highlight about people being detained as they are following their due process. So people who have open asylum processes, people who have been complying for decades, for years, going to their meetings, checking in, following what is prescribed for them, what is afforded to them by law. So they're doing the due process, because oftentimes you'll hear or you'll read on like social media commentaries of news, oh, just follow the rules, just follow the law. These people are. They're doing exactly that. We do have a process for asylum seekers. At least we had one. And these people are being caught up in that sort of wide net. And then the other thing that I think is interesting to highlight in conjunction with this process is the fact of the hundreds of thousands of people whose TPS, temporary protected statuses, are being canceled. This is being done solely for the purpose of ramping up numbers, because at the end of the day, what Stephen Miller and these sycophants want is numbers. They want to have a show of force. They want to have the claim, you know, Donald Trump loves to be the first, the biggest, the strongest, et cetera. So he wants to have the numbers to say we deported the biggest number of undocumented folks. And so they are actually having a resort to remove the documentation for folks so that they can meet up those numbers, because the criminology statistics, the sociology statistics, the demographic statistics simply do not support the fact that undocumented immigrants or immigrants in general are criminals or a threat. In fact, they are the lifeblood, the backbone of our society in terms of food harvesting, production, meat packaging, construction, digging the channels for and the ditches for fiber optic cable. We could go on and on and on. And so this is just a show of force, a cruel show of force, that is capitalizing on real anxieties that people in this country are facing in regards to the economic and health conditions of this nation. So when times are rough, unfortunately, people in power have learned that they can exploit fears and manipulate people to blame marginalized communities, because that's an easy scapegoat, and that's exactly what we're seeing right now.
Yeah, and I think it's important to point out too that you know, that the process, you know, for a migrant you know, to earn citizenship in this country, you know, it's a years long process. I mean, it takes decades, or a decade at least. You know, in some cases. So, you know, the fact that there are people here who are, you know, in the middle of the process, but they have been here still a long time and have families and have established homes and have assets and all of a sudden, you know, like we pointed out, you know, they're going just for their regular court date, you know, and the next thing they know, they're in detention.
Yeah.
You know, I'm curious too, you know, because you're involved with farm workers, you know, are there, you know, I don't know, so to speak, crops being left on the vine to rot? I mean, is this starting to, you know, impact, the food chain?
Yes, absolutely. Just yesterday I was reading a report about California, tomatoes, being, going to waste. We have heard also instances here in the state of Florida of not having enough people, either because they're afraid to show up or because they've been deported to come in and harvest or prepare the fields. I think the fall will be quite telling for Florida. Most of the – at this point, it's too hot to be planting by and large. So the fields, if anything, the type of work that's being done is clearing and preparing the fields for the fall season. So we shall have a better indication in fall as far as the ability of farmers, ranchers to staff their operations to the extent that they can reach their quotas or goals. But we have already seen in Florida and as I mentioned in California as well. And I imagine there's other cases throughout the United States that this must be taking place as well. In dairy industries, there have been some raids in Vermont. It's just a matter of time for these stories to make it out. And in fact, we already see the agricultural sector pressuring the Secretary of Agriculture. Trump has waffled here and there saying, oh, there's going to be amnesty for farm workers. And then he gets blowback from the Stephen Miller types. And then he says, oh, no more amnesty. Yesterday, the Secretary of Agriculture was saying that we're going to get people on Medicaid to do this work. It's just amateur hour. It's cruelty. It's bad policy in addition to it being mean. God only knows where we're going to end up within the next couple of months.
Let me just interrupt for a second. I just want to remind listeners who may be just tuning in. This is WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. And I'm speaking with Ernesto Ruiz, research coordinator for the Farm Workers Association of Florida. And while we're talking about cruelty, I guess we can't leave out, the news story, that's at the top of the fold these days, the so-called alligator Alcatraz, the detention facility in the Everglades that was recently opened, which by the way, I did read something that Thomas Kennedy pointed out. He works with the Florida Immigrant Coalition, that just naming it Alcatraz was a misnomer and it was unfair, because these aren't criminals,
Absolutely.
I actually did a little piece a couple of weeks ago about pointing that out too. The real Alcatraz did house real criminals, and the only crime these people have committed is, trying to make a better life for themselves and their families. But anyways, this place has opened up, and do you know of anyone who's been sent there yet? I mean, I know most of them are coming from Miami area, right?
Yeah, you would think so, but there's also this pattern of, moving people far away and in sort of haphazard ways. We've had folks detained here, and then they'll spend a couple hours at a local county jail, and then all of a sudden they're in Louisiana. Who knows? Who knows where they're coming from? Makes sense for them to be from South Florida, but I imagine they're going to be housing people from all over the country. I have not at least heard yet of folks being detained there. But yeah, you're absolutely right. It in terms of naming Alligator Alcatraz, it's part of the psychological campaign to create this depiction of migrants as dangerous and to intimidate and to strike fear into the heart of communities, which again, I won't tire of calling this cruel, because at the end of the day, that's the underlying thread that Chris just that cuts across all this approach. It's cruelty. It's performative cruelty.
Yeah, and there are a lot of reports of what the conditions are like in there, because I guess it's only been just a few days since the first group was brought there, I think maybe as many as 1,000 have been mm-hmm. transported there, directly out of, I believe, South Florida jails. There are some reports coming out by, I guess, the wives of some of the men that have been incarcerated there, being detained there. And it doesn't sound very good,
Not at all. Not at all. Yeah. We've heard horror stories from the Chrome Detention Facility. These places are, as you mentioned, they're designed to hold criminals. These folks are not criminals. And they're grossly overcrowded. And I think, something that's also important to mention is that we have private contractors who are making an absolute killing with this process. This is not being done just for the sake of a political show of demonizing immigrants, because, unfortunately that does result in the bolstering of certain political candidates, such as the president. But beyond that, it's being done perhaps fundamentally because it is lining the pockets of very influential people who fund the campaign of Donald Trump. I forget the exact numbers, but one of the two private contracting companies donated into hundreds of millions to the Trump inaugural fund, hundreds of millions of dollars. And now these people are lining their pockets with a new source of a seemingly endless source of people to lock up, to process, to feed, to clothe. And these are private contractors. So just like we've done with the healthcare industry in this country, with the pharmaceutical industry in this country, the prison industrial complex is a for-profit endeavor, and this should send chills down the spine of every single person in this country, whether you are right-wing, left-wing, if you don't care, atheist, religious. They are making money out of locking up people, and as soon as you start to make money off of locking up people, then the incentive, as we see with healthcare, is no longer quote-unquote criminal justice. The incentive is to maximize profit, and that's exactly what we're seeing. We're seeing a trial run of a new model of incarceration. We already have the president being quite explicit about the fact that how naturalized citizens might be next, green card holders. This is a trial run to suppress dissent. Again, not only is it a damaging and dangerous political ideological territory, but it is also lining the pockets of the already ultra-wealthy, which should, again, send shivers and down the spine of every single person in this country.
Yeah, it should, and I'm glad you brought up the point that the president has expressed an interest in finding ways to deport naturalized citizens, and that would include it. And it seems like as much as he claims he claimed before the election, he wasn't just going to be seeking vengeance. He is seeking vengeance. And that could possibly include, not just, dark or brown-skinned people, but anybody who has spoken out against him. It should, like you say, put shivers down everybody's spine. How about these plans to, or these plans that they brought up about people self-deporting, and they would get some kind of reward when they arrived in the country of their choice if they just like left on their own? Is that, what's that all about?
Chalk it up to Mexico is going to pay for the wall. Just more nonsense. Like, how do you enforce that? No, of course not. Like, it's perhaps that's the carrot that follows the proverbial stick. I don't know. It's nonsense, Lou. It's absolute nonsense. And to your previous point, even Elon Musk is at risk of being deported now. So you can give hundreds of millions of dollars to this administration, and now, please do not take this as me defending Elon Musk. If they deport him, I will not shed a tear. But just to highlight the fact that one of the closest people who have contributed the most in ideological support through his social media platforms, through money, to this administration now is being discussed as perhaps being deported as well, which should show you the level of sycophancy, the level of fascist tendencies of allegiance to a cult leader that we're experiencing right now.
Yeah, true that. And also, too, the incorporation of the U.S. military. I mean, I don't know if they're here yet, but wasn't there talk of 200 Marines being sent to Florida, just like I think it was like 600 that were sent to Los Angeles, who are allegedly there to protect, and I say that in quotes, ICE, because ICE is, has such a dangerous job and are being threatened, right? I mean, it's...
Right. I haven't seen them. I imagine Ron DeSantis is salivating at the chance to flex his military muscle, so to speak, and intimidate folks. And as I said, this is a step-by-step process in which the boundaries are being pushed of constitutional governance. And it is likely a matter of time, as you suggest, for military enforcement to start being directed more and more towards people within this country. Which is terrifying. It's terrifying. And it's also just ideologically ludicrous, given that typically and historically, you have one of the most prominent right-wing Republican talking points, this fear of federal government intervention, and then this lauding of the Second Amendment to provide the sovereign citizens and the local militias the ability to resist federal tyranny. And where does that ideological conviction go for the moment that it is being used in quote-unquote, your ideological favor, and you're targeting people you don't care? There is no conviction. There is no, these people do not care about anything other than being in power, and that should terrify us all as well.
Trying to turn you know, everybody against everybody else, you know, is kind of the point of it. You know, I mean, they create this chaos, and there's, you know, you're thinking of like some little old lady in Kansas or something, you know, who's afraid, you know, some Venezuelan gang member is going to break into her house and rape her, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's nonsense. And that's another thing too. I mean, this whole business about the gangs. We got to round up MS-13. We got to round up Trendyagua. What happened to them? Where are they? Why are we not so concerned about them? And how about those, you know, 200 guys that got sent to CENTCOM in El Salvador? Mm-hmm. You know. Based on the fact that they alleged, or the government alleged, that we're being quote unquote invaded, you know, that this is some kind of invasion, you know.
Right.
I think a more apt name for, you know, somebody else came up with this, instead of alligator Alcatraz, it's alligator Auschwitz, because it's
basically
a concentration camp, you know.
Absolutely.
And that's what's going on. It's just, you know, that level of persecution, I think,
I don't think it's a stretch, and I think, like, the evidence, again, bears this out. Let's talk about violent gangs. Yes, arrest every single violent gang member. Process them with law. Process them through the judicial system. If there are legal grounds to deport them, then deport them. Okay, but let's look at violent gangs. Let's look at the violent insurrectionists who stormed our capital and who try to interfere with the constitutional transfer of power. And then we have this administration pardoning them. So again, people, we have to be intellectually honest. We have to be ideologically honest. If we're going after violent gangs, then let's go after violent gangs regardless of their color of their skin and their political persuasion. We have Sheriff Joe Arpaio, who a decade or so ago was pardoned by Trump. Not a decade ago, you get my point. He was found contempt of the law. Like, so let's be consistent. Are we about law and order? Then let's be about law and order, but let's use law and the legal institutions and constitutional infrastructure to enforce it. We can't just pick and choose. We can't just pick and choose, because if right now, if you don't care about this because they're going after the quote unquote enemy, well, guess what? You know, sometimes they might come after you. Are you going to care about them? Are you going to care about it then? Like, we have to be consistent. Rule of law has to be consistent. Otherwise, we will fall apart. We'll fall apart into chaos. And to your point about, like, the poor women in Kansas being terrified about a gang member from Venezuela coming in to assault her, you know, 99% of the Venezuelans in this country have more in common with that. 99% of those rural women in Kansas, or where have you, they have medical debt. They have credit card debt. They can't afford their rent. The food that we get is controlled by three or four corporations who are poisoning us. They also control the fertilizers. What we have here is a distraction from a very small minority of ultra wealthy people pitting us together, because it's a successful strategy, because it's been employed throughout millennia. We pit the poor against the poor, one color against the other, and then, you know, the emperor in the background is dancing with no clothes, cutting deals with Core Civic and Geo Group and Monsanto and Halliburton. And it's a distraction. It's a distraction. 99% of Democrats have more in common with 99% of Republicans, with anarchists, with atheists. We are experiencing harsh conditions here, and it is because of those harsh conditions that these crazy conspiracy theories can flourish, these fascist tendencies can flourish, and we need to do better, every one of us, myself included, and to remind ourselves that we live in community and that the people in our communities are not our enemies. And if you go out in the streets, you will see this. It's not mayhem. It's not gang warfare. The vast majority of people live in places where they trust their neighbors, where they get along. We're still a nation of civics, and, you know, we need to hold on to that quite dearly.
You know, I definitely hear you, you know, and I have to say, you know, I've been in the construction industry, both on the West Coast and the East Coast of Florida, you know, and I have to say, you know, the immigrant workers that I worked with, you know, were all hardworking, great guys, you know, and just, that, you know, that's all they wanted to do. They wanted to come to work, do their job, you know, and this idea that they create any danger. And then again, too, you know, of course, you know, I have to say, you know, I'm the son of an immigrant. So, you know, I was born here, but my father was born in Italy, you know. I mean, what's that going to mean, you know, at some point, you know. But anyway, I digress. All right. Okay, well, you know, is there anything I'm leaving out, Ernesto? This is you know, just a sad situation, and I hope we can survive till 2026.
I hope so, Lou. You know, I don't think you're leaving anything out, and I wouldn't say that it's a digression, but your commentary about your grandfather being an immigrant, because where do we draw the line? Your father, excuse me. Who gets this? So 10 years is recent, 100 years, like, this whole country is a country of immigrants. Not only a country of immigrants, a country of invaders, you know, unfortunately. Half of them were brought here forcefully from Africa. We stole land from Native Americans. We stole land from Mexico. From Texas through California, that was stolen. Come on, now we get the chance to say, oh, no, now it's different. We claim this. Come on, man. It's moving goalposts. It's immoral. At the end of the day, we're all people. At the end of the day, the vast majority of people are trying to make by and support their families. And we need to do better, all of us, to see through the chatter and the distractions that the corporate class is using to distract us and pit us against each other.
Yeah. All right. Well, you know, please tell my listeners how they can learn more about, you know, the Farm Workers Association of Florida, and anybody else you want to let them know. People need to be aware.
Yeah, sure. So we're not the best at promoting ourselves. I guess the best start would be if you go onto our website. We are a grassroots community-based organization with 5 offices in the state of Florida. We seek to improve the conditions of farm workers. We're called the Farm Workers Association of Florida. One thing that has been heartening for us is we're receiving a lot of attention and interest for people to volunteer with us, saying, hey, how can I help? So that's, you know, it's always welcome. It's something that we need to do. And yeah, one last thing I say, yes, it's very heartening for us to see all of these protests and these movements of resistance. We just have to be careful, you know, not to be co-opted by.
Once again, you know, I really want to thank you, Ernesto, you know, for making time for us, and hopefully the next time we talk, there may be some good news.
Okay. Yes, absolutely. Please do. Thank you. Appreciate the work you do. Thank you so much, and take care.
Something fierce is rising from the Everglades, and it's not just the gators. A viral social media campaign is sweeping across Florida and beyond, calling out companies complicit in the construction and operation of the newly built ICE detention center on sacred Everglades land, known to the public as Alligator Alcatraz. This movement, dubbed Drop the ICE Contract Challenge, is part of a growing anti-fascism campaign founded by grassroots resistance group called the Florida Valkyries. It's not just a hashtag. It's a day-to-day name-by-name call to action targeting vendors who are enabling what advocates describe as a modern-day concentration camp, right in the middle of the ecologically fragile and spiritually significant landscape. To accept the contract from ICE in this context is to betray human rights, environmental protections, and indigenous sovereignty all at once. And to do it for profit, that's complicity. The Florida Valkyries are here to say no more. The Florida Valkyries are not your typical advocacy group. They are fierce, unapologetic, and relentless in their demand for accountability. They understand that fascism doesn't arrive all at once. It builds slowly with the quiet cooperation of those who sign contracts, deliver tents, or set up pest control systems. This campaign is about calling those people and companies out. It's about refusing to let them hide behind the excuse of neutrality. Neutrality in the face of injustice is itself injustice, and there's no neutrality when there are children in cages and people imprisoned on sacred ground, the Florida Valkyries said in a statement. Among the companies that are being targeted is U.S. Tent Rentals, Mosquito Joe of Naples, IRG Global Emergency Management, and CDR Health. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman.